The first 2,800 people who joined the police force, the official, the peelers, only 600 of them kept their jobs. And you know the way police get numbers when they join the force?
They do.
Number one lasted 4 hours and was dismissed for drunkenness.
Is that great?
And welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host, and our guest propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. I know a fat old policeman. He's always on our street. A fat and jolly red-faced man. He really is a treat. He's too kind for a policeman. He's never known to frown, and everybody says he's the happiest man in town. But they don't know that at night he goes home and cries about his crippling weight issues and that the red face is a sign of the imminent heart disease that will one day kill him. Yes, the laughing policeman, a far sadder song than you realised. And alongside me, the allo, allo, allo to my what have we here and the allo, allo to my dodgy French accent, it's Ben Vandervelde.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, wow, you turned that laughing policeman into the Joseph Grimaldi story.
I know, it's quite sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you think about it, he's never known to frown, he's got no intimidation ability, he's quite fat and red-faced, he's not good at chasing criminals.
He's on drugs.
He's a community support officer, I think.
That's right, no, he's just doing sort of like the most efficient policing possible.
Mm.
Also,
that song always terrified me, by the way, when he starts laughing. It's quite maniacal.
Yeah, well, it is the sort of stuff that you'd imagine they have on the playlist that they use to break prisoners of war. Like that and the Purple People Eater and all those novelty records will really ruin you.
The yellow polka dot bikini.
Yes. You always have to be wary of police officers who don't look like police officers. I might have spoken about them before, but there's a mate of mine who's now an ex-copper in his 50s. Who is a comedy promoter, and in his spare time he does ultra marathons.
Of course.
And like, you know, does like the marathon de sable and going up and down the Grand Canyon. Mm. And so when he's like on the beat, if a young buck nicks something and Gary starts to chase them down there, it's like, I'm going to be absolutely fine. I'll outrun Tubby there. 6 miles later and Gary's just getting into his pace. And they're like, right, fine. Have whatever I stole back.
That's it. They need long-distance runners as policemen, not sprinters.
Yeah, absolutely. You need your Mo Farahs, not your Usain Bolts.
Yeah.
I should introduce this week's guest. Our guest this week is wonderfully qualified, particularly for our topic. He joined the police force after a drunken bet with his father on his 18th birthday couldn't stay in the force for 6 months, which is my favourite opening line to a bio we've had so far. He stayed for a further 30 years, serving in Hillingdon, Westminster and Ealing Borough Station.
Really rubbing salt in your dad's wounds.
Oh, really.
He was awarded the Police Long Service and Good Conduct Medal in 1993 that I assume he waved in your dad's face, and the Queen's Golden Jubilee Medal in 2003. He retired from the police force in February 2010 after completing 30 years service. He has also written briefing notes for two prime ministers, TV scripts for Gerry Anderson and Doctor Who, helped build dinosaur skeletons for the Natural History Museum and movie monsters for Bruce Willis to shoot at. He is a writer on QI and its sister show, The Museum of Curiosity. He's also appeared on the No Such Thing as a Fish podcast and has been set on fire twice, kissed by Princess Diana once, and Freddie Mercury once wore his helmet. It is nicely. It is our lovely guest Stephen Colgan.
Hello,
Stephen.
That's amazing.
Well, your description just now, the other guy, the retired policeman, 50 something, it was all going so well. I thought they're talking about me till you got to the running marathon. Because I've eaten a few marathons. Well, they're called Snickers now, of course, just to ruin that joke. But no, I mean, whenever there was someone ran away from me, I usually had some young probationary officer. You just fed on Mars bars and milk, and you just
fetch,
set them off like a rocket. Yeah. I mean, they were cheaper than police dogs.
The '80s was a hard time.
Everything else that I've learned about you, I imagine that if someone nicked something, you would have stood there and sort of tried to calculate something, pressed a red button, and then Wallace and Gromit dial of a Heath Robinson contraption would go off and land a plant pot on their head.
That would be great. That would be great. It would be great if life worked like that. No, I mean, lucky I never had many runners. I was very lucky because I when I was involved in investigation, it was invariably me actually sort of working out who someone was, then banging on a door and having their lovely surprise face when you haul them out.
Did you have,
he got cornered.
Did you have absolutely. A pin board covered in white pieces of paper and then red you know, it's, lines going across
It's one
them?
Of those things that, you know, I almost hate talking about because there's so many sort of memes and tropes in cop dramas. That in 30 years as a cop, I never saw a notice board with bits of red string and tying anything up because everyone had it on computers.
Of course you did.
I never saw someone draw a chalk outline around a body because someone just took a photograph of the body and then it was shipped away, you know, so you had the photographs of where it was in situ.
Well, chalk washes away as well. It's quite impractical.
Yeah, exactly. I never saw a body bag. You know, this one, this moment, you know, the poignant moment when they zip the body back over the person's face and they go, oh. Never saw a body bag ever. These are just, you know, NHS just throws a red blanket over people, and then it's only red because you don't get the stains, you know.
But you could unfill the blanket and use the thread from that to do your pin boards.
Well, you could if the pin boards I ever saw it. Yeah, there's so many things like that, like the putting the wires together under the dashboard to try and start a car, or suffocating someone with a pillow. I challenge everyone.
As a dodgy cop who has done something wrong and their partner's found out about it.
I shouldn't challenge people. Hey, people out there, try and suffocate someone with a pillow.
While crying, obviously.
It's actually almost impossible because most pillows are filled with fibre or feathers, but there's a lot of airspace between them. You'd literally have to shove it right down their throat, I think. Or, of course, you put a pillow on someone's head and they're conscious, just turn their head sideways. it's actually a really difficult thing to do.
It's quite a relief you've given it this much thought.
Well, there is a certain morbidity. You do see a lot of death and injury in the police. It's the one nastiest, when people say to me, you know, what's it like being a cop? What's the worst thing? That is it. It's the knocking on the door and saying, your teenage son's been killed in a car crash. But you do see a lot of death, and it's you do become a bit morbid, and you do get cops sitting around on night duty in the canteen saying, well, if you were going to murder someone, how would you do it? You know, I've worked out three or four ways. I think I'd get away with it.
But I've got some examples for my research.
but I'm not going to say.
Well, that's good that you're getting inside the mind of criminals.
That's it.
One thing that I found out about you from our friend Simon is that you're very good at lateral thinking. And he says you came up with the idea of giving late night revelers lollipops on the way out of nightclubs to stop them getting involved in fisticuffs.
Well, I'd love to claim it was my idea. I was part of the team that implemented it and came up with the idea. And there are plenty of other ideas I did come up with. But the idea was that you had clubs that were kicking out at night, lots of complaints about noise, fights ending up outside the club. And obviously, you don't want the clubs to close down because they provide, you know, entertainment for the local people and they bring money into the area and that sort of thing. Plus, you just become a big killjoy, you know. Yeah. You just want to control the bad behaviour. And we went and sat outside these clubs and listened and watched what was going on, just sitting there, you know, in plain clothes, you know, doing an observation, basically. And what we realised is that the two main things were that blokes were quite often a little bit punchy when they came out because they'd had too much to drink, and the women were incredibly loud. There's nothing sexist about this. Women have higher voices. Their voices carry further as a result, and they tend to hang around in groups more, so that the noise was much more from the women. And we thought, what could we do to keep the women quieter? And, you know, there were jokes about, you know, we could issue gags, you know, ball gags and things like this. But the first idea...
Somehow the glass of the lollipop idea was off.
Didn't really work. But the first idea was toffees, but then...
toffee apples.
You know, people chewing a toffee can't make a noise, but, you know, after we tried a couple and pulled a few fillings, someone said, what about lollipops? We can't remember to this day which one around the table said it at the team, but... yes, we tried the lollipops. And the lollipops are great because you can't shout, you can't make a noise when we're sucking on a chupa chup. Oh, no, advertising. On a lollipop or any other variety. And similarly, we think the sugar was probably quite good because people are a bit dehydrated and a loss of energy because they've been dancing all night. But the big thing, that the unexpected secondary benefit, was that blokes weren't quite so punchy. Maybe it's because it's something childlike, you know.
Yeah.
Or, you know, maybe it's a breast fixation thing or something, you know. I don't know, but whatever it was, when blokes got a lollipop in their mouth, they didn't want to fight anymore. It was just brilliant. And the whole thing was
sucking something like a finger.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just, like a pacifier, you know. Yeah. And it kind of rolled right across London.
That's like the lateral thinking of, is it Edward de Bono proposed sending Marmite to the Middle East?
Because it's got more potassium in it, and there's a deficiency in potassium in the diet there, so it'll make people more rational.
Which is a good thing. I love that kind of lateral thinking. The problem with some of that stuff is that it kind of creates this idea that, sort of, oh, lateral thinkers, they're what you need and nothing else. And it kind of forgets the fact that, yeah, you've come up with this idea and Edward's gone, Marmite, okay, bye, off he goes out the room and someone's going to make that happen. So you do need strategic thinkers. You do need sort of planners. You need marketers. You need people who are emotional thinkers who understand how people think, you know, advertising people to actually try and change people's mind to get them to eat more Marmite.
Well, that's the big issue. Only 50% of the Middle East is going to eat it.
Well, I reckon they'll start another war, wouldn't
Well, exactly,
it?
Yeah.
But this is the issue. You've got to have a whole range of thinkers around a table. Yeah. The whole lateral and creative thinking thing is all about having a range of thinkers, because between them they come up with ideas no one else ever had.
And I have to say, with the lollipop thing as well, it is a great idea, but my Scottish best mate and my Scottish wife, when I told them, it both went, I can make a weapon out of a lollipop.
Yeah.
Princess Diana and Freddie Mercury, was that at the same time?
No.
You know they spent a night out together in the Royal Vauxhall Tavern?
They did, yeah.
Has someone written a play about that?
I think it's a couple of people, I think, are working on ideas.
I think Kenny Everett was there as well.
The two of them and Kenny Everett had a night out. They disguised Princess Diana. I think they may have even stuck her in drag. Yeah. And Ian had a night out in the RVT.
That's amazing. That's such a great prince and pauper style tale.
Yeah. No, queen and princess style.
Yeah, good point.
No, I just got pecked on the cheek twice by her when I was doing some protection stuff around Great Ormond Street Hospital when she was there doing one of her showpiece visits. When she was paying one of her visits to the hospital.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, well, it's self-edited.
Well, yeah, but it's royals. I mean, it's what they do, bless them. The Freddie Mercury thing, it was the year after Live Aid.
Yeah.
Queen, their star was back in the ascendant again.
That was the year Wembley, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they did, it was the Can of Magic tour, and they did two nights in Wembley Stadium, and it just so happened, I was working at Ealing at the time, and I was back out on the street, I was in uniform, and I was just what they call aid, is where cops from a whole bunch of boroughs are loaned to a borough that's got a big event on to bolster the numbers.
Yeah.
And I was actually inside the stadium right next to the stage for both nights.
Amazing.
And at the end of the second night, one of the roadies came running down off the stage, because at the end of the show, Freddie Mercury used to come out in this ermine cape and a crown, and they used to do God Save the Queen as he walked across the stage. And on the second night, which is the final night of the tour, one of the roadies ran down off the stage and said to this old copper next to you, who probably joined in the 1950s or something, said, hey, can Freddie borrow your helmet? And he went, Freddie who?
I went, oh my God.
This is a cop who took the earplugs out of his ears before he answered as well.
Oh, good Lord.
And he said, can he borrow yours? And I said, yeah, all right. So gave this roadie my helmet. And he took it up on stage and I'm sitting there waiting. I was waiting, A, to get told off for giving my helmet away, and secondly, for Freddie Mercury to come out on the stage wearing it. And we saw him in the wings with his helmet on, and it was way too big. Because I've got a really big head.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a bucket. When I was at Hendon, when I was doing my initial training, they didn't have a helmet big enough for me. So, and in fact, what they did for the class photograph, they loaned me the outsized one that they had on display in the uniform stores. You know, like in perfect.
Your head is display size.
Yeah, it is. My head's display size. And Freddie put this on, and it basically came down and covered most of his head. So they sort of whipped it off and whipped it out, and he came out with his crown on again. But I went home thinking, Freddie Mercury's DNA on that.
That's a very copper thought.
It was.
I could frame him for a number of things.
Oh,
I'd have loved it if Freddie Mercury had come out with a hat covering his eyes, and it would have looked like the biggest ever immersive version of Nightmare.
It would have been really funny.
Just teeth.
Yeah, just teeth and a little tash. So I
would have been delighted.
You are a hugely multi-talented man, but we do like to ask people what they are worst at in the world.
Mm.
What is there that you really don't excel at?
Well, interestingly, and it kind of ties in with the subject we're talking about, because one of the things I'm really bad at is guessing who done it. kids.
There's two things wrong with that. First of all, that's your job. And secondly, guessing.
It was my job.
I didn't say
I was good at it.
Yeah, it's true.
But no, real life is very, very different from murder mystery. Because, I mean, I've made that point in the most recent book I've written, you know, the idea that murder mystery and real investigation are just poles apart. You know, there's no crossover at all. So if it was a very organized, step-by-step, procedural investigation, I was really good at that. I was really good at the analysis and thinking my way through things. But when you've got to piece together the fact that there was, you know, a fillet of salmon left on a plate and a string of pearls on a bedside table and a light bulb that only flashes every 30 seconds. You know,
two goldfish in a pool of water.
Absolutely. I'm absolutely rubbish at anything like that. And my missus takes great delight in it. Because first of all, Christmas every year, there's always board games because my kids are all in their sort of late 20s and 30s now. And they come around at Christmas and out come the board games and it's always, Cluedo, Dad, Cluedo. God, not Cluedo, because I'm never the person who guesses whoever it was in what room with what instrument.
Yeah.
And the other thing is watching things like Murder, She Wrote. My missus will sit there and go, she did it. And this is like 5 minutes into the show, and at the end, sure enough, she's right. And after she'd done this about 20 times, I was thinking, I've got to find out how she does this. How does she do this? How does she work it out?
It's always the person they show a close-up of their fingernails at some point doing something innocuous.
You know? Oh, my God, oh, it's things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. It's their nail varnish as the giveaway, or... Yeah, the way they were holding, they do a weird close-up of the side of someone's head at some point for no apparent reason, because that's the shot later on.
Absolutely. Well, what I got from my missus is, I said, so how did you know that she was the murderer? And she goes, well, she always plays baddies.
We are, as you can probably guess, talking this week about the world's worst policeman. I'm sure we'll have lots more tales out of cop school from Steve. But we're going to first of all start with Ben. Ben, what did you learn? Ben has a big book with him this week, by the way.
I do.
It's a really big book.
It's a great book. I thoroughly recommend it. It is the more famous book by these people is Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable. But this is Brewer's Dictionary of Rogues, Villains and Eccentrics. Mm. And it's great.
You could club seal cubs to death with that. It's huge.
That's the ending.
That's the ending of the podcast.
We've done there.
It. Oh, it was the Inuit.
We're just recording a podcast.
It was
Where's
the
seal
with
cub
the club. On the ice pack.
Look, I have my my polar bears to feed. That's
He's
my alibi.
He's a man on the edge.
So the first chap I'd like to speak about is an 18th century, and it's almost a bit unfair to call him a copper. We'll start with gentleman and then move on to thief taker, Jonathan Wilde. And Jonathan Wilde grew up in Wolverhampton, worked as a buckle maker. He then deserted his wife, moved to London, and ended up in debtor's prison. And in debtor's prison, he sort of got involved in the criminal underworld, made mm-hmm. loads of connections. And when he came out, he opened a brothel with a woman he'd met in there. And they worked in tandem, and he worked as her twang. Do you know what a twang is?
It's not a piece of slang. It's
the sound an arrow makes.
No. It is. No, the twang is the name of someone. While the mistress was off servicing the client, the twang would rifle through their pockets and steal all their wherewithal.
Oh, like in the waiting room.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
The guy with the key to the lockers in the changing room at the gym.
Precisely. That is, you have a very strange picture of what brothels were like. You don't have to go there with a 20p and then check in your bag.
Do you not get like a little rubber strap with your key on it at the same time?
Do you have to have a shower first to go through a foot bath?
Yeah, absolutely. Verrucas were a real problem in brothels.
Yeah, that was the problem. They were focusing too much on the foot hygiene in brothels.
Yeah, rather than the waist hygiene. Yeah.
Some of the prostitutes had fantastic slang names, didn't they? Some of the ones I can think of is that was fire ship. I've been with a fire ship. Yeah, that's obviously a lady with the pox.
Yeah. Yep.
But there were loads of them like that. There was a threepenny upright. That's where you get the phrase a below job. It's where it comes from, apparently. Yeah, because it's above job or a below job, sir?
So it's not about the, because it's sucking rather than blowing anyway.
Well,
so
absolutely.
It's not about
if you're blowing, you're doing it wrong anyway. But well, apparently so. Well, according to some dictionaries of slang, that's where it comes from.
Amazing.
But some of these names are fantastic. But I love a throp me upright.
Oh, I think I'm getting a piano delivered today.
A very, very small piano. Yeah.
Let's get back to your twangs.
Yeah, that's his apprenticeship in the criminal underworld. Mm-hmm. He then, what's interesting about him, so he starts up as a criminal, but he then sort of plays either side off against each other. And he went to work for a chap called Charles Hitchin, who was the Under Marshal of Newgate Prison. And what he would do is that he would have a variety of thieves in his employ, and then at a certain point, when the thief needed to be caught, he would catch them, put them on trial. The trials would be rigged so that the thieves would either get off or have a very small amount of time in prison. And if they ever like told on him what he was doing, he'd be like, right, well, I'm going to exact swift revenge on you.
Amazing.
What he started off doing in the criminal underworld, he'd act as something called a receiver. And a receiver is someone who would take things that are stolen by thieves
Absolutely.
And then sell them
like
and make profit.
It's a
defense,
yeah,
exactly.
The offence is called receiving stolen goods.
Yes, yes, yeah. Of course.
And then, but what he would do instead, he would make sure that before items were stolen, the thieves would case the joint of the people they were stealing from, find out who they were stealing from, he would set up a lost property office and then sell goods back to the people that they'd been stolen from and create this wonderful closed loop. Amazing. Of...
A lost property office where you had to buy your items back?
Oh, yes.
Wow.
Or, or expect a reward of some
TFL
kind.
TFL funding could really... if they had a little thing.
But he was making money from both sides. He was making money from people stealing things and selling them back to the people who were victims, and also, every now and again, throwing the nascent police force... not even the police force, just the authorities, the councils and the government... a criminal.
I'd be an estate agent now, wouldn't I?
Absolutely would. He got in a bit of trouble with Charles Hitchin. Charles Hitchin didn't like him. Mm. And so, because what Charles Hitchin afterward was as an agent provocateur to try and uncover sodomites and other perverts of the age. And he wrote a pamphlet.
It was a great time for us back then because, you know, wigs were very in fashion.
Yeah, wigs, a lot of makeup.
Yeah, great. And, sparkly clothes.
Yeah. So Charles Hitchin tried to frame Jonathan Wilde for what he was doing as a receiver, and it didn't really receive much press. Jonathan Wilde wrote this massive long pamphlet about Charles Hitchin being a homosexual, and the public went, oh, well, that's salacious and brilliant. We'll not have that. And he fell from grace.
Amazing.
Hitchin was eventually pilloried, which I think is the posh word for being stuck in stocks.
Yeah, but the stocks were your feet, isn't it? The pillories were your head. Yeah. Head and hand. Yeah.
And because he was so afraid of what would happen because of contemporary attitudes towards homosexuality, he went in the pillories in a full suit of armour to try and protect himself.
I like this.
Yeah.
He didn't like the bending over thing.
Didn't work, still got pilloried to death.
Oh, God.
Meanwhile, we get to the mid-1720s, and the government... basically is regretting employing Jonathan Wilde as someone to reduce crime because they've basically cracked onto what he's doing and are trying to find a way to frame him. He is eventually charged with receiving 10 guineas for stolen lace. Stolen lace, what a time. Yeah. What a time that was an illicit good. And his defence was, sorry guys, I have helped you hang 67 criminals.
I've earned my antimacassar money.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's right. I've paid the doily tax. Yeah.
The police weren't having any of it, and a year later he hung.
Oh, good.
And he actually tried to commit suicide the night before by taking an overdose of laudanum, but for some reason he hadn't eaten, and so the laudanum didn't take effect in the way that he thought, and he was just really boozy and sleepy. So he sort of went to the gallows in a strange fever dream.
Oh, bless him.
So he certainly has to have a mention.
Definitely.
Popping to the 20th century, there's Detective Sergeant Harold Challoner. In 1964, Harold was put on trial for perverting the course of justice. However, the psychiatrist at the trial declared him mad as a March hare. everyone else who was accused went down. He didn't, and most reporters reckon it's because he was faking it. And the term doing a Challoner was coined in the criminal underworld for basically pretending to be nuts.
Wow.
So he didn't go down.
Was he UK-based?
Yeah, he was British-based.
Right.
He's astonishing career. He started off in the Special Air Services during World War II. He then joined the Flying Squad. My two favourite things about him are this. His way of... He also inveigled himself into the criminal underworld, and he befriended a low-level thief who basically went, listen, I'll take you along to the pub where all the criminals hang out, and I'll point out who the criminals are, but you can't come dressed as a policeman because that's far too obvious.
Right.
Was so this London?
This was London.
So, like, cray time.
Cray time. So, what time is it?
It's cray time! For the blind beggar and all of that.
He went dressed in drag. And in a
that's scene... his story.
Yeah, that's his story. In a scene redolent from a Carry On movie, he went into the men's toilets by mistake and sort of laughed it off, going, I'm sorry, I've had a couple of sherries and I'm an awfully giddy.
I'm a lady.
And then brilliantly, he got propositioned by a member of the criminal underworld and his sort of criminal guide had to just go, oh, no, she's with me, silly old cow.
even better.
We've all done it.
Yeah, we all.
All been there.
You know, what at first looks like an astonishing cleavage is just a pair of coconuts pushed together.
It's very hairy breasts, a coconut.
You'll take what you can get in the north.
Hairy cleavage, yeah.
In 1963, he was looking after, or basically watching over an anti-Greek protest. The Greek royal family were in town, and they were part of a very right-wing government, and so lots of civil liberties protesters were protesting against them. And in order to frame these members of the civil liberties, I mean, I don't know if you have experience of framing people, but you might know the odd tactic here and there.
Well, one's heard stories.
One, of course. His tactic was to plant bricks on them and to suggest that they were going to use the bricks to throw at the royal family.
How do you discreetly plant a brick?
Well,
on
exactly.
Front? It's not like you can like slide it.
Side around, and one side of your jacket goes.
Ooh, yeah. Such an appalling tactic, and obviously the members of the Civil Liberties Organization were acquitted because there was no brick dust in their pockets.
And obvious.
He was suspended from duty, and there's a quote from him that's wonderful. The whores danced outside the Old Bailey when Oscar Wilde was jailed, glad to see a menace to their own profession locked away. I mean, it sounds like Eric Cantona is his scriptwriter, doesn't it? He was breathtaking. But yeah. My suggestion for the world's worst policeman is we're going to go to Victorian times.
Great.
So we've had, you know, a thief taker before they were policemen, and then a wonderfully lunatic cross-dresser, but we're going to talk about William Stewart Poppet, and it is claimed that he's sort of the founder of the detective system and was a early forerunner of undercover police work. And
already knowing this is the Victorian era and dress up, I'm so excited.
I'm sad to tell you that he doesn't turn up in drag.
Oh.
Yeah, sorry guys.
Even I've dragged up.
Yeah. So in the mid 1830s, or the early 1830s, in fact, there was real problem with sort of sedition from workers' organisations and political unions. Mm-hmm. So he was sent to the National Political Union to pretend to be an undercover coal miner, which is an absolutely terrible Hollywood movie.
Yeah.
Undercover coal miner. Yeah, in a double bill with Billy Elliot.
In a world.
Yeah.
Underground.
Where no one can see whether you're on the good side or the bad.
Damn it, William, your Welsh accent's not good enough. Why do you keep bringing soot home, William? Why can't you tell me what you're doing?
Trouble at mill. Someone's got to say it.
What's beautiful about his story is he went too deep undercover.
Literally,
because he was a coal miner. He started marching arm in arm with them and singing French revolutionary songs. He started doing such radical speeches and behaviour that he was elevated to the status of union official because he won an election he wasn't meant to win.
Wow.
And
he's Donald Trump now.
Yeah, he is. And he said that he would like to establish a shooting gallery for them to practice that, and also to teach the miners and workers how to use broadswords for future altercations in the street.
He's gone full Patty Hearst here.
Absolutely. And he was uncovered because another union official, John Fursey, was walking past the Parkhouse station one day and saw him sat at his desk in full uniform. And basically, he was dismissed for going far too deep. In the same article, I found a similar story of a chap called P.C. Barnett, who was an undercover police officer in the 1840s in Birmingham, and he infiltrated the Chartists. But again, basically, he was such a man who was dedicated to his job. When he wasn't working, he didn't have any civvy, so he would just wear his uniform.
Oh, yeah.
And a Chartist went to the theatre and saw him sat there dressed as a copper. And he basically went, oh, no, I'm one of the actors. I mean, I'm a bouncer at the theatre. And the Chartists were like, bullshit you are, mate. You're acting undercover. But the original gentleman who created undercover work was William Stewart Poppet. And not only
did Parliament disapprove of him because he'd gone too deep? But also there was a huge movement against him because, in the words of a select committee, any approach to the employment of spies in the ordinary acceptance of the terms is a practice most abhorrent to the feelings of the people and most alien to the spirit of the Constitution.
It's sneaky.
It's just not cricket.
Didn't play fair.
Absolutely. He didn't play fair, but he didn't play well either. So for those reasons, my suggestion is William Stuart Poppy.
Well, I went through, you know, the usual sort of sources. And again, the same names like Challenger and Challenger and Poppy pop up. And I thought, Poppy pop up. and I thought, no, let's take a slightly different route. And I thought, let's talk about the average everyday cop. Because it just seems that from around 1840 to about 1900, almost every dismissal of a police officer was for drunkenness.
Yes.
And the joy is that... And I suddenly remembered that years and years ago when I was working, I was actually working at Hendon at the police college. They've got, there's a thing that comes out regularly called police notices, which is all the, it's a bit like births and deaths, is who's joined, who's left, yeah, who's transferred, that sort of thing. And if you go back to the old ones from the Victorian era, they're still in existence, you know, they're still there. And when you go through and look at some of the reasons people were dismissed, and I found some absolute classics. I mean, things like, I mean, these cops at that time, they were on 3 shillings a week. They were expected to work 7 days a week without meal breaks. And they were expected to even sleep in their uniform just in case someone needed them. I mean, it really was, you know. And on top, which everyone hated them. The working class hated them. Yeah. The toffs liked to steal their helmets and piss on them from the top of the building. You know, you've only got to read a bit of P.G. Woodhouse to see how the police officers got dealt with at the time. But you find some amazing things, like a P.C. Rogers in 1830 who was dismissed for being drunk and fighting with a woman in Tufton Road and abusing P.C. Clark and pulling off his coat to fight him. You know, that's a regular dismissal. Or Francis Masters in 1840 was jailed for endeavouring to stab his sergeant with a pocket knife. He was trying to take his beer off him.
I've read the first 2,800 people who joined the police force, the Peelers, only 600 of them kept their jobs. And you know the way police get numbers when they join the force?
They do.
Number one lasted 4 hours and was dismissed for drunkenness.
Isn't that great?
My God, it's like a Royal Rumble, isn't it?
It was staggering. I mean, it just goes on and on. Frederick Wilding found in a tap room drunk and wildly dancing while on duty.
I mean, his surname just
Frederick Wilding, yeah.
suggests.
When under the influence and coming off duty, drunk before his superintendent and under the influence of liquor before the commissioner. Yeah, the double whammy there. I think my fate. Oh, some here. Complaint by publican of constable making water in a spittoon in front of his bar. Or in 1893, a PC Holmes making water on top of a cistern. Which I thought quite clever, actually, I think.
He must have been very tall.
Well, the cisterns were very high. I think he was doing one of those. Well, I see that. But yeah, he was sacked for highly improper and for being highly improper and filthy. You get others that were... It was a PC Jones in the same year who was suspended so that he can have a bath and cleanse himself before he came back to duty. But
I can have to suspend you because you're going to need about a week's worth of cleaning.
Yeah. But my absolute favourite is a guy called PC Clears, who apart from being in a filthy state from vermin and not cleansing himself as directed, was sacked for this brilliant offence of drunkenness. He was sacked for being absent from his beat and found drunk and asleep with his head through a pane of glass in a greenhouse. He is my top cop. Anyone who can get so drunk they can stick their head through a pane of glass in a greenhouse and stay asleep and be in a verminous state. Got to be best cop ever.
A fat and jolly red-faced man, the red is from the tomatoes he planted.
Oh, the blood. Oh, so much blood. Yeah, so PC Clears would get my vote just because that's a staggering thing to be sacked for. Oh, I got sacked again, dear. What for? Greenhouse this time.
I'd banned from another allotment.
He'd probably be great bans, PC Clears.
Oh, amazing. PC Clears. I love him.
You have some Murder, She Wrote stuff we were chatting about before the show.
Well, I was also thinking about, you know, because you think about TV detectives and things like this, and I mean, clearly the worst TV or film detective ever has got to be Frank Drebin, isn't it, in Police Squad?
But I don't know. I always have a thing against Inspector Morse because people think Morse is brilliant,
smart,
but Morse, no, he's shit. Watch every episode; he guesses about four different people before he gets to the right person. You just go, oh, I think it's Steve. Oh no, wait, he's been proven. Every Morse episode has, in the same way that most of these have a formula, he'll guess wrong four or five. Sounds like he's right up your street. Actually,
yeah,
you should
but
play
that's
him
more
against
like real life. Because you do get the facts come in, and the facts start to sort of coalesce. You think that fact goes with that one. You think, ah, it could be him.
Yeah.
So you pull him in for questioning, and you do do a statement and then you find there's an alibi and you think, well, it can't be him, let's try that one. You quite often will go through three or four people before you find the culprit.
That's so true.
That's yeah. slightly more realistic. Now, the ones that get me are things like Murder, She Wrote, which it has like a Scooby-Doo ending every time,
yes.
doesn't it? Where, well, the murderer is such and such. And it, without saying, you know, pesky kids and all this sort of thing, you know, as soon as they're cornered, they go into this great, yes, well, the reason I did it was this. Whoever does that?
Yeah, no one ever monologues.
No, you've got to take them to court and winkle every single bit out of it.
It's because she never reads the Miranda rights. Oh, they don't realise.
I know. It's just a nightmare. But no, I'd love... the one thing I love about Murder, She Wrote is that Cabot Cove in Maine, the place where Jessica Fletcher lives, is the murder capital of the world. It genuinely is.
So good.
Some guy on Radio 4, some researcher on Radio 4, actually looked at how many killings there were per head of population there. Whenever you see an establishing shot of Cabot Cove, there's a sign saying Cabot Cove population, I think it's 3,500.
Mm.
And he worked out that there'd been 274 killings. I mean, there's apart from all the other killings that happen elsewhere, that everywhere Jessica Fletcher goes, interestingly. Yeah, there's been 274 killings across the series in Cabot Cove, which if you use that per million, it works out about five a day, basically, in this little main village.
They have completely misunderstood the government guidelines, haven't they?
Haven't they? Yeah. This is your five a day. Yeah, but it gives them an annual murder rate of 1.49 per million, which basically is more than 50% higher than on Honduras, which is 910 per million. It's just amazing.
Yeah,
absolutely amazing. Yeah, 1,490 per million. 50% higher than Honduras. Also ahead of El Salvador, which recently celebrated a unique milestone in the fact that it had the first day in 3 years where no one was murdered.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's the sort of stuff they're always trumpeting in New York City.
I know.
I'd like to hope in all El Salvador and New York City police stations, it's just a big counter above the chief's desk and just keeps getting reset. Maybe tomorrow.
Days since last murder.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
In Iceland, there was a big deal in 2013 because... it was the first time that the Icelandic police had ever shot a criminal in action.
Yeah,
it's in 2013. Even though Iceland's quite armed.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of
country of 300,000 people, and a third of them have guns. It's the 15th, I think, most armed country in the world.
Absolutely.
But the police had never shot someone while in the course of duty until about 4 or 5 years ago.
Why are they so armed? Because the lovely meme that goes around Facebook every Christmas about Iceland is the fact that they all buy each other books and give them presents the night before Christmas. Yeah. And there's a special Icelandic word for we're all going to read books together as a happy family.
Yeah, but all the guns are things, all the books are things like, you know, how to clean your...
Yeah.
how to break down a Heckler & Koch 45.
Yeah, a mother's guide to the AK-47.
I think it must be hunting, I imagine.
Yeah, it probably is. I would think so. And also that...
Because if you want your seal properly killed, forget the club ban.
Yeah.
It's a newsie.
But I'd say it isn't just... I mean, Midsummer is our British equivalent.
Yes,
and
of course.
Midsummer Murders also has an exceptionally high murder rate. It's on a par with Chile and Latvia. and Midsummer's meant to be kind of around where Oxfordshire is. And if you assume it's about the same size... They've got an annual murder rate of 32 per million, which is about 21 murders per year, which is, you know, about three times what Oxfordshire actually has.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting when I started looking into this was the fact that if you go back to classic cop shows, you know, your Columbos, your Quincy, your Perry Masons and all that sort of thing, Rockford Files, the murder rate in those shows is far lower than reality.
Is it?
Yeah. So the murder rate across all those series... is about 29 per million, when in real life, LA's about 230 per million. It's 10 times more.
Was it the same back in the day? Well, it will have been, won't it?
It would have been, yeah, absolutely. So the cop shows, you know, even though there's all this murder and mayhem going on with Columbo and Jim Rockford and all that sort of things, they're actually presented to the American public a sort of utopian view of how things could be in LA. There's only 29 million people being killed instead of 230.
He's doing nothing at the start of this episode because there hasn't been a murder in weeks.
It's staggering. It seems in the 70s it was almost as if they were presenting a nicer view of the world.
I suppose the big question is, do you view their job as prevention or detection, though? Because does that make them bad police or bad cops because all these murders are happening? Or are they good cops because they keep catching the murderers?
Well, that's the way you got to look at it, isn't it? Yeah.
A preventative cop show is such a boring show, though, isn't it?
I spent the last 10 years of my police career actually working pretty much solely in prevention. That's where this whole lollipops thing came on, and using things like, you know, using wizards to stop people from street gambling and using...
What?
Well, we had a problem with...
Sorry, using the band Wizard. Was this through your Queen contacts?
That's right, Glam Rock Detectives. Now, that was a series, wasn't it?
I would so watch Glam Rock Detectives.
It was a series.
You serious?
It was a series in the 80s, no, I think, or early 90s. Yeah, the Glam Rock Detectives. It was terrible, but it was a series. But it was a case of we were trying to stop people from doing, you know, these people, they sit on the side of the road doing the three-card trick and the balls with under the cups.
Oh, yeah.
And it was really difficult to catch them because they're very well set up. They've got sort of lookouts and shills, you know, sort of dupes in the audience say, yes, I will do this as a member of the public and win some money so that everyone else does. And they usually pick really good open spots where there's lots of escape routes. So it was really difficult to tackle this. And we thought, well, what we should be tackling is people actually going out and placing bets, because it's called the three-card trick for a reason. You know, the clue is in the name. it's not the three-card you might win something. It's the three-card trick. And a good three-card trickster, you're never going to win. And I proved this because I went to see a magician. Obviously, I hadn't seen it. I thought, let's go and see a magician and find out how it works. And I met this guy. He was the only young lad. He was 19 years old, called Emmanuel Fire. And I sat in a cafe with Manny across the table. And he did the three-card trick with me for about an hour, and I didn't beat him once. And at the end of it, I said, that's absolutely amazing. You're 19. Some of these guys have been doing this 30 years on the street. Amazing. A whole hour of doing this, and I didn't beat you once. He said, yeah, and I didn't get your watch as well. And my watch was gone. And I do not know how. I can't even remember him touching me, let alone undoing the strap and taking it off. But that's how good these people are.
Yeah.
So I suddenly thought, if we can show the public that this is a trick and they're not going to win, they'll be less likely to gamble. Because the important thing here is, we're not trying to do some sort of Del Boy type good old boy character on the street who's just trying to make a bit of money.
Yeah,
these were organised teams. The money was going back into sort of human trafficking, prostitution, drugs, all that sort of thing. We wanted, and it's a really big source of income for a lot of these crime teams and crime families and syndicates. So we wanted to close them down. So the best thing was to show the public that it's a trick. So I said to Manny, how do you feel about doing this in public? We'll get a couple of big hairy ass coppers standing next to you, you know, so you're not beaten up by the people. But if you do this in a shopping centre and show people it's a trick, then they'll stop putting money into it. And he was up for it. And I mean, he was a young lad with big round glasses. He was halfway to Harry Potter anyway. So we stuck him in a wizard's outfit, and it worked. And it worked brilliantly.
It's all about branding.
Yeah, and I've seen the same thing. They did the same thing in America. A lot of the, you know, the professional magicians were so fed up with these guys doing it it was in Washington, near the Washington Memorial. They set up a whole bank of magicians and people doing like the three-card trick to show the public it's a trick. So it's kind of prevention. You know, we did all sorts of weird things. We held dog shows to try and bring fractured communities together, because dogs are a great unifying force. You know, if I see someone on the side of the road and just walk over to them as a stranger and say hello, they think, oh my God, it's a nutter. But if you've got a dog, it's like, oh God, your dog's lovely.
Blah, blah, blah.
I've got an excuse to talk to you. And we went onto some quite dangerous estates, you know, ones where there was an emerging gang problem or there was an existing gang problem, been stabbings, you know, and a couple of shootings and things. And we found invariably the problem was the community was so fractured. Everyone just went out to the shops and went home again. No one spoke to anyone. But nearly everyone had a dog.
Yeah.
So organising a dog show, they all came out. And you realise you're starting to make an impact when you've got some little old lady with a Yorkshire Terrier on a lead, and she's having a go at this big lad with a Rottweiler.
Yeah.
And she's having a go at him because his dog's overweight. So what are you feeding him? And he's going, I don't know. What should I be feeding him? And you think, these two would have crossed the road to avoid each other in any other circumstance.
Yeah.
It's just a great... And that sort of prevention work is so, so important. And because I think if you went out onto the street and you got 100 people randomly and said, would you rather get burgled, but the police are really good at catching burglars, or would you rather not be burgled? It's fairly obvious what most people would go for. And yet all the emphasis is all the time on catch the bad guy, catch the bad guy. And if you try and do anything that's a little bit left field or unusual, but it works like the lollipops, you know, there are certain newspapers that will just absolutely parrot, you know, go for it. You know, police giving out lollipops when they should be catching bad guys. Now, catching bad guys is a badge of failure because it means you've allowed a crime to happen.
Yeah, it's like, no, we should be treating cancer rather than finding a cure for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, if you use that sort of medical analogy, yeah, you can train doctors and nurses and build hospitals and develop drugs, but it's a lot easier just to find the pond where the mosquitoes are and fucking bomb it. Get rid of the problem at source. You know, there's a great old allegory, an old story about some guys out camping, and they're sitting by a river, and suddenly one of them sees a baby floating down the river. So he dives in, saves it, brings it out to the bank, and they're going, oh my God, how did this happen? And they see another baby, and the other guy dives in, grabs him, and eventually they are constantly diving into the water saving these babies, so they haul in some of their mates to help save the babies. And you know, in time they develop an entire rescue outfit, and they have buildings, they've got like a little rubber dinghy with an outboard motor, and they've got an orphanage, and they've got schools and all these things built. And then one day, one of the original campers starts walking up the river, and they say, hey, where are you going? We need you here. And he says, I'm going up the river to find out who's chucking the fucking babies in the river. That's what prevention's all about.
I read a little bit about the first police forces, professional police forces. The UK's first one, sort of funded by local taxation, was set up in Glasgow in 1800. But they had other jobs aside from crime prevention. They were sort of roped into a bit of firefighting, basically any job that was going. And they served Glasgow up until 1975. The Irish Constabulary was set up in 1822, which became the RUC, now the PSNI. But the first professional policemen, the Peelers, set up in 1829 by the Home Secretary at the time, Robert Peel. And they were organised with 17 divisions, 4 inspectors, 144 constables in each, run out of London, Scotland Yard, the head of everything. And aside from the drunkenness, they looked quite natty. The long blue coats and the strengthened tall hats.
Oh, top hats,
which were especially strengthened so they could use them to stand on to see over walls if they were chasing a criminal.
They absolutely could. And there are places, like in Covent Garden, there's a couple of places where you can see hooks actually on the wall. And that was for the police officer to hang his coat on.
Yeah.
But it was too hot.
They also had the amazing truncheons. They weren't just the plain black ones. And they have these like beautiful decarative crests on them and everything.
Like so carved wood. And
embossed. Things and when you're being smacked over the head by one when suppressing a riot or a protest, as it's coming in to hit you in the face, you go, oh, that's quite pretty. And they also were issued with rattles to raise the alarm.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's like those football matches.
Instead of whistles, they're just the little football ones.
Oh, they're called Gregors, aren't they?
Is that what they're called?
Yeah.
Amazing. You were right, yeah, they were quite afraid that poor people did not like them. Because there was a big fear of suppression. There was a lot of sort of workers' rights and sort of a bit of suffrage rights happening at the time. The Peterloo Massacre had happened in 1819 when the army had killed a lot of protesters in Manchester. And so there was quite a slow uptake in joining the police. Even though there was a bit of money coming in a regular job, people were shunned by their friends if they did join. So by 1855, so that's what, 30 years later, still only about 12,000 police in all of England and Wales. Mm. There was a big lack of interest in them. They were people thought they were too expensive to have them anyway. They weren't really regulated. And it was only in the 1850s onwards that they started to really firm up how they were run. And I read a bit about modern police as well and some of their choice weaponry that they have now, particularly in America, big fans of the military weaponry.
Getting army knockoffs.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Skunk water. Do you know what skunk water is?
If I tell
you something, a quote about it from a journalist says, it's like dirty diapers mixed with old roadkill that's been left in the sun.
Oh.
It's a liquid that stinks so much like that. So when it's sprayed over you, you can... It's a deterrent, obviously, that they might be using you, but also if it is sprayed on you, it's really easy to track you down because you just follow the smell. You set Pepe Le Pew on the trail.
Probably smell like PC Clears.
Yeah. And but naturally, it wasn't invented by the Americans, it was invented by the Israelis. In September 2015, it was reported that US police forces are now stocking it, along with California police, who have had a go at using nunchucks in the 80s, especially when... suits were brought against them by protesters and themselves because they were breaking their wrists and trying to use them.
Staggering.
Yeah, we were chatting about this yesterday. Like nunchucks strike me as a terrible
nunchucks
battle.
Nunchucks do strike weapon. You,
yeah. That's what they're for.
Brilliant, as you were.
Nunchuck and a seal cub.
We're getting closer.
Yeah. That is definitely a generation game challenge. Just on the Arctic tundra.
There's the taser shotgun, which has 4 times the power of a taser with the electrocution length of 20 seconds and 100-foot range. Which is a taser, of course, a non-lethal weapon which has already killed over 500 people. So what that non-lethal weapon needs is to be made 4 times stronger. And in August 2015... taser drone was invented.
Oh no.
And North Dakota tried to pass legislation banning all of these
non-lethal weaponry on drones and managed to, in some sort of payoff for some other thing, say, actually, you can't have lethal weapons on drones, but non-lethal weapons are okay. So they now have drones which have rubber bullets on them, pepper spray and tasers.
It's amazing.
Cathedral Police. Did you know there's Cathedral Police?
Yeah, there's an Atomic Energy Commission police as well.
Is there really?
Yeah, there's a nuclear police, which I think...
just hanging out in Chernobyl.
Well, they just guard atomic premises, you know.
Amazing.
Yeah, I know.
I didn't know there were cathedral police. Apparently, Liverpool, Canterbury, Chester, York, Minster, Hereford has had some in the past. Washington National Cathedral in America has it, and St. Peter's Basilica obviously has the Swiss Guard.
And are they just armed with holy water and crucifixes?
Stop or I curse!
Yeah. But the York ones are really interesting. The York Liberty Constables were set up in 1275, and they're still going. They had a little break at one point, and they've changed their names, I think, but pretty much still they're the oldest police force in the world.
Like some of the Beatles in London. Yeah. They've been there for hundreds of years, haven't they?
And York Minster, I didn't know this about York Minster. York Minster is huge. It could fit the Leaning Tower of Pisa inside the central tower of York Minster very easily, and it contains 60% of England's stained glass in the one Minster.
Wow.
And so this they were set up in 1285 because it was during Henry III was having a lot of battles with barons, particularly those based up in Yorkshire. And so to protect their various properties, they set up this sort of constabulary to protect the cathedral. They had their power of arrest taken away in the 1930s, but it's just been reintroduced last year. Largely, apparently, because it's to protect against, you know, terrorism and stuff like that. Well, they have to be able to arrest people. And they dress in a kind of like, in a sort of halfway house between policemen and security guards.
You were saying earlier about sort of somewhere between police officer and security guard.
Yeah.
It's all kind of homogenizing anyway, isn't it? What's really weird is when you go to America and you walk into somewhere like, you know, Walmart, and security guard's standing
cops,
there.
Yeah.
And he is a cop.
Yeah.
Because cops in America are allowed in their spare time to work as private cops.
Are they?
Yeah, so it's like, I'm off duty. Well, the thing is, they want people who can handle firearms and are licensed to and all the rest of it. And they'd rather have someone who's been trained with firearms. So the cop will just finish his work, you know, take off his police blues and then put on his, you know, ASDA uniform and go and stand in a corner with a gunner and then become the security guard. And it's perfectly acceptable. It's the way they do things.
Oh.
But I went out and worked with several American police forces and the FBI. And I won't name the force, but something that every force you go and stay with or you work with in America, the first thing they want to do is take you out onto the firing range because, you know, have you seen a gun before? You point it this way. You know, because they think the Brits have never seen a gun.
There's about 17,000 police forces in America, I realize. It's the most decentralized in the world.
It is. It goes from sort of like giant forces like the NYPD down to some you know, guy and his dog in Pig's Knuckle, Arkansas. You know? it really is very strange. And even sort of between counties. And, of course, they've got different levels. They've got sort of like the local police.
Yeah.
And then you've got the state police. And then you've got the federal police. Yeah. It's like different levels as well, which is really difficult. But no, you go and stay with a police force. And the first thing they want to do is show you their shooting range. They take you out and they let you have a go with all the guns. Now, I've been shooting most of my life. I grew up in Cornwall. As you can tell occasionally when I get some of my flat vowels. Right then, boy? I grew up in Cornwall, and I grew up literally with a shotgun in my hand because most of the protein we ate when I was a kid was rabbit and pigeon and stuff like this.
And you never know when anyone will try and walk across your farmland anyway.
Well, there's that as well, yeah. We land! I'm a reasonably good shot. So they gave me these shotguns and submachine guns and pistols and that. Went out on the shooting range, and I scored pretty well. In fact, I found out afterwards I'd scored higher than the firearms instructor. And I said, surely you should be a really good shot. He said, no. And this particular force, and it may be the same across several different American forces, but the pass rate on their shooting course, the pass rate was 40%. Ooh. As long as you got 40% of your bullets kind of in the right place, they'd let you have a gun and put you out in the street. I said, and I scored like 90-something, and I said, why is it so low?
Is that an E in an exam and an F?
Yeah, I know. I said, why is it so low? And he said, well, because a lot of them are really bad shots, but cops have got to have guns, and we wouldn't have any cops if we didn't let them through. So they lower. Yeah, and you, when you hear things like that, and you start to look at these dreadful situations, you know, that they get over there where people are being shot left, right and centre, it's no surprise, because not only are they not very good shots, a lot of them, they you know... It takes a lot to pull a trigger to shoot someone and kill them. Yeah. So invariably, the ones that do all the shooting are the ones who should never have been given a gun in the first place.
Yeah, and growing up in Ireland, the Irish police is an unarmed police force. Yeah. So coming over here even and seeing like the transport police or people like that wandering around with machine guns and train stations still freaks me the fuck out.
Yeah.
It does me.
Yeah. You guys have grown up with it. I did like reading in New Zealand... In 2010, there was a paper that suggested it's more dangerous being a farmer than a policeman. And said that the paper argued that arming the police would actually cause an arms race between the police and the criminals, which would make it more dangerous.
I thought you were going to say an arms race between the police and the farmers. No. The police wandering down the high street with a scythe.
Yeah.
There's kind of truth in that. If the criminals, and it's why we're not armed in this country habitually, the cops, because if they know that every single cop's carrying a gun, they're all going to go get guns. You know, there's going to be a certain escalation.
Yeah, and the paper said only a dozen or so New Zealand police officers are armed at any one time nationwide.
Wow.
It's only about 12 guns on the streets.
Such an adorable country.
But, you know, guns is only one way of preventing crime. What about moustaches, Ben?
What about moustaches, Ben?
Yeah, in 2004, in Madhya Pradesh in India, police were being paid to grow moustaches. About 30 rupees a month, which is 66 US cents, which isn't much in America, but quite a decent amount in India at the time.
Fortune.
I know, right? But yes, Steve has ample facial hair.
Yes, I'm hirsute. Yeah. Hair grows on me like weeds.
So the district chief of police, a guy called Mayank Jayan, he was at a seminar, and he said there were two or three mustachioed constables at this gathering, and I saw people looking at them very respectfully and pleasantly. And so he thought, mustaches make people respect you.
There you go.
So he sort of got members of his police force to start growing, and he gave them instructions on. He said a good one has to take a turn near the angle of the upper lip, so a slight little upturn. And he said, he said it's working. Mustaches are improving the personalities of our constables. They're acquiring an aura of their own. They're creating a positive impression on the local people and getting a lot of respect.
I can see that. Well, you know, like, so Steve just turned up the edges of his moustache, and it's because it's a happy look. Your facial hair is smiling, so I want to smile looking at it.
It might be different, yeah. If it was a sort of a droopy Fu Manchu style one, it might quite have the same impact.
India, one of the really great examples I saw recently of actually using the culture to prevent crime from happening. There's a lot of problem with street urination. A lot of problem with street urination in London, frankly, but there's a lot of big problem with it in India. They found the way to deal with it, particularly in sort of stairwells and places like that, is to paint religious icons on the walls. So that no one wants to piss on Ganesh, Ganesh, no one wants to piss on Shiva, and I saw it again in Sri Lanka. They had pictures of Buddha everywhere, so people didn't piss on the walls.
All about waist height.
Yeah, so I was trying to think of an example we could bring that over to London. Wouldn't you piss on?
They've started putting...
Welcome to Who Wouldn't You Piss On?
With your host.
David Attenborough.
That's what it's got to be.
Just Attenborough murals everywhere.
So just Attenborough murals all over the walls with his mouth open.
Yeah, Dame Maggie Smith.
Yeah, that's what you want.
That's how you know that you're a national treasure, because you're turning into
Michael Palin.
Well, the opposite of that is a few years ago we were trying to deal with the problem of chewing gum dimps on the ground, was to get the celebrities that maybe weren't quite so popular and just stick their faces on boards and people stick their chewing gum on it works really well. They trialled it out in Brighton and we nicked the idea, and it was like 20,000 pieces of gum going on these boards instead of on the pavements.
A few pictures of Quentin Letts all over the place.
Mick Hucknall covered. Politicians are always favourite, of course, and Piers Morgan covered.
Piers Morgan, the chewing gum would actually unstick itself from the pavement and chunk straight onto it like a magnet.
I have one story about the Irish police, the Garda Síochána. In February 2009, the Irish Times reported that over 50 different speeding tickets and parking fines had been issued across the country from Cork to Cavan for this one guy whose name was Pravo Yazdi. And the way he'd managed to avoid their detection was that he'd give a different address each time. So he was given the same name but different address all the time. And there was quite a large, not a manhunt per se, but there was a big sort of force-wide notice saying, listen, this guy... 50 plus fines and tickets. It's beginning to stack up. We need to track him down. He's ripping the piss. And the Irish Times reported that in June 2007, a letter was circulated by a police member of the Gardaí who had discovered that Pravo Yazdi is in fact the Polish for driving license.
Yep.
And Poles being the second largest population in Ireland... when handing over their Polish driving licences, had the wrong bit read by various Irish police.
I thought it was going to be some sort of shadowy Kaiser Soze figure.
No, it's very much not the usual suspects. It's lots of different suspects.
Absolutely. When I read that at the time, I just couldn't believe it. I thought, how can they not have spoken? How can no Polish person have said, Excuse me.
Just, you know, I've written down the wrong thing.
I think they just kept it to themselves. They didn't go public over the phone. We're looking for this guy. If we tell him he's coming, you know, we're coming.
Yeah.
You know, he'll hide. So we won't say that we're looking for profit. Yeah.
My candidate for the title of the world's worst policeman is every member of the force of the Waldo, Florida police force in October 2014. So Waldo, Florida is a tiny little town in northern Florida. About 1,000 people, about 2 square miles in size, and the AA of America put up these signs warning that it was a speed trap. It was infamous for being a town that it was quite a straight road right through the middle of it, and a lot of cars and trucks and things would be pulled over and issued with speed fines because the police were hot on the speeding problem going through their town. It's the one of only two towns nationwide, the other one being another one nearby called Lawty, which had these AAA signs outside them saying, beware, speed trap. And it turned out that half of the town's $1 million annual budget came from speeding citations, which obviously helped pay for the police force. And the problem behind all of this was that they were just, you know, issuing these fines to hit quotas and pay their own wages.
I can believe it.
So they were mishandling evidence and issuing speeding tickets that weren't speeding tickets and raking in the dollars to try and make sure they kept a job for themselves. Even so, it was a sort of self-perpetuating cycle of, we don't need all these police, but we've got all of them now. We need to pay them, so we're going to keep issuing these, and it kept snowballing. So the chief of police had to resign when the story came out. An interim chief of police was appointed, and shortly after, he had to resign as well.
Brilliant.
And the entire force was disbanded in October 2014 when the local police, the federal or the state police, took over running of everything. And then they just said that the problem's so endemic, we just need to disband the whole thing and start all over.
Fantastic.
Again.
One of my favorite things about speeding is again, it's this whole, if you're trying to stop crime from happening, people always use sticks, and carrots work so much better. And in Scandinavia, I'm trying to remember, I think it's Sweden, they tried a thing a little while ago where they thought, well, instead of just hitting the drivers at speed, why don't we reward the ones that don't?
Mm-hmm.
So they put up these speed cameras, you know, like number plate recognition things. And if you went through, bang, you're over the limit, you've been reported, you'll probably get a fine. If you went through under the speed limit, it was, thanks for driving under the speed limit, nice smiley face on the board, you've been entered into the good driver's lottery. Uh-huh. And what happens is every week, randomly, one of those good drivers whose car's gone through there and the NPR has picked up their number plate. That's what NPR stands for, in case anyone doesn't know what NPR is, number plate recognition. Everyone who went through there who drove under the speed limit had a chance of winning, you know, sort of £20,000 in the lottery. And the money came from the fines.
And it probably turned out in the long run to be cheaper to give 20 grand away rather than having to, you know, do all the paperwork.
And there was a 40% reduction in speeding.
Of course there was.
It's amazing. But although the traffic did become more problematic because people would actually go out of their way to drive that way. so they were, you know, but there's always people who will mess up the system. But yeah, they'd actually go out of their way. Let's take this route today so that our number plate gets picked up going through.
That's
here.
Massive bottleneck of everyone driving at about 10 miles an hour waving at the camera. Yeah. So our candidates this week for the world's worst policeman are Ben's suggestion of undercover miner William Stuart Pope, Steve's suggestion of PC clears. If you live in a glass house, mind you don't throw a policeman. And my suggestion of the traffic cops of Waldo, Florida. You know what? I love PC clears.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, William Stuart Pope sounds great. Hilarious to have at parties. Probably would have gotten on quite well with Challoner in the cross-dressing.
Yep.
And the Waldo, Florida police, bless them, they were just trying to, you know, pay themselves a living wage. Whereas PC Clear is the perfect example of incompetent Victorian policeman. Yeah,
I can imagine him on a postcard. You know?
And verminous. Don't forget verminous.
Oh, yeah, very important to remember.
Which doesn't specify what type. It could have been rats. It could have been pigeon shit.
I can imagine he's been covered in rats as well. I imagine they were probably talking about lice and fleas and things like this. Just to make it even better.
Or baby seals.
Yeah, I'm not moving him. I'm just leaving him there.
So congratulations. PC Clears wins the title of world's worst policeman. Before we go, I have some of the world's worst news of the week, and this comes from Japan. A school in Japan has adopted Giorgio Armani uniforms for their students, triggering massive criticism, including in the country's national parliament. Taimei Elementary School in quite an upmarket area of Tokyo, Ginza, has announced plans to introduce the optional Italian designer uniforms, which cost more than 80,000 yen. That's £525 for the full set. The government officials said that school principals did have the sort of right to set the fees and the requirements for their schools, but this case did not have parental consensus, which is probably a vital factor.
Surprise. Well, at least it wasn't Hugo Boss.
Proud suppliers of uniforms to stringent regimes.
Yes.
Like Tokyo elementary schools. before we go work, Steve, can people find out more about you and your books and everything else?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. The current novel, which is called A Murder to Die For, is currently in the shops. It's in fact, I just went down to Waterstones in Trafalgar Square and just signed a couple.
Oh,
no, yeah. It's lovely seeing it out on tables. Oh, I love seeing the books on tables. That's very yeah, that's very exciting.
Pick it up and it feels real.
It does, yeah. And I'm just crowdfunding the sequel at the moment through Unbound, if you've heard of them. Well, but yeah, A Murder to Die For in the shops now.
Do you have a website that people can find it on?
No.
No. Just look up Stephen Colgan, A Murder.
Yeah, if you look me up, it's Stephen spelt really stupidly. S-T-E-V-Y-N. Stephen Colgan, and you'll find me. Fine Irish name.
Yes, excellent.
It means swordsman.
Yes, it does.
Oh, yes, ladies.
Which is that poor baby seal.
Oh, Jen. Yeah.
Yeah, well, Mr. Popeye would be delighted with you. Yeah.
Meanwhile, we're all off to cover Ben in soot and chuck him through a greenhouse. Thank you for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Goodbye. Well, that's another greenhouse well and truly ruined. Ben and I have been, since we recorded this episode with Stephen, we've been going around chucking Ben into allotments, looking for tomatoes to arrest.
I mean, essentially, this podcast is standing in a greenhouse throwing stones at the outside world. And finally, we've met a policeman who has reached our level.
Thanks so much to Stephen for doing the show. Do find a copy of his book, A Murder to Die For. It's brilliant. The idea is such a great idea. As I said, I think I mentioned last week on the outro last week, it's about a crime writer sort of convention. Everyone dresses up as the writer, an Agatha Christie type figure, and then a murder takes place at this convention. It's such a great idea.
Yeah, and also if you do pick up a copy, you'll notice that there are quotes on it from Stephen Fry and Sandy Toksvig. Now, obs, because Stephen used to be a QA elf, but they don't just give away their recommendations willy and nilly. So if you like either of those two excellent humans, you'll almost certainly like this book.
Yeah, do give us the usual love and support online. We are nothing without social media love. Find us on Facebook, Worst Foot Forward, on Twitter, at Worst Foot. Find Ben, at Ben Vandeville. I'm at Baz Maxtay. And send us an email to worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. We love getting your lengthy and effusive love letters. We haven't had any. I'm just hoping that'll sort of spur people.
Oh, mate. we've had lots of Twitter and Facebook engagement, but literally no listener has emailed us. Yeah. So
there'll be a prize for the first listener to email us.
Yeah.
We haven't decided what it is yet.
If you are a policeman or policewoman and you have done something really badly wrong and you want to confess to us, then you tell us, and we promise not to tell your commanding officer.
We'll just read it out on a podcast.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be amazing if we uncovered an international drugs ring that way?
Yeah, to be fair, if some policeman is looking for a confessor, I think we're the obvious people they're going to turn to.
Damn right.
What else to talk about? You've got something to tell people about, don't you?
Yes. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I plugged a date that I was doing in Cambridge based on a fairly modest number of listeners that live in Cambridge. However, I have a show in London that I would like to promote, and our boys in the Stats Lab have told us that there are lots of you that live in London town. I am doing the very, very first work in progress of my next solo stand-up show. It's on March the 14th at 5:30 in the evening at the Bill Murray Pub in Angel. You can find it if you search for my name, Ben Vandervelde, the show's name, Fabulist, or the club's name, Angel Comedy. And I know 5:30 seems a little bit early, but if you are unemployed or a student or do not care for your job, then come and join me there, and I will make up some fun jokes for you for an hour.
Bunk off early.
Yeah.
Be really cool and leave your work early and say, oh, I've got to go to a cool comedy gig. And any try and stop me.
Yeah, bunk off early, but before you go, get all of your work colleagues to sign their names on the back of your shirt, like it's the last day of school.
Coming up next week, we are joined
by the wonderful Tez Ilias. Tez is a very rapidly rising star in the world of British comedy. His first Edinburgh show has become a Radio 4 series. He's about to go off on a big UK tour. And as a Blackburn Rovers supporter, he has joined us for our second football episode. We're going to talk next week about the world's worst central defender. It's an episode rampant with own goals, with corruption, with hearkening back to Baltic players who joined Arsenal in the early noughties.
Yeah, so again, like previous sporting ones, doesn't matter if you're not a fan of football, there are enough absolutely cracking stories of intrigue and mishaps that you'll enjoy this one too.
All right, see you next week.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.